Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I don't know many 93-year-olds that can...
That are alive? Yes, I agree.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
I know that some scumbag in here knows one of the guys who murdered my wife. His name's Sirk Brantner. So if you know Sirk, or if you know any information about the killing of my wife, if you could just raise your hand and stand up and come forward.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 141 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dyser.
Heidely ho, discount Tom Hardarinos.
Yeah, there you go. And also being joined by Jeremy Scott.
Ah ha!
There you go. That's what we came here for. Jeremy's weird reactions to things. Today's big recommend is, of course, Upgrade.
It's not upgraded?
Aaron tried to slip us a Mickey there. That is definitely not the movie that we're going to be watching today, but I am glad that he took the time to create a logo for a similarly named movie. I would also like to thank chat for coming out here and watching us talk about movies on a, I think it's a Tuesday. That's right. That's correct. All right, Jeremy, do you want to start us off with a small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Oh boy, howdy, do I ever. I gotta talk about this Penguin show on HBO Max. Spinoff from the Batman from a couple of years ago. Colin Farrell in unrecognizable heavy makeup and bodysuit. This is an 8-episode show that picks up 1 week after the end of The Batman. So half the city is flooded. Most of it is without power. The most powerful gangster in the city, John Turturro, has just died. And Oz Cobb decides to try and fill the power vacuum in the underbelly of Gotham on his own. There are still two families, the Falcones and the Maronis, sometimes called the Falcones and the Maronis. It's kind of interchangeably. I don't really have a problem with that. And basically, he goes about trying to play them off of each other and try to make bargains with both sides. And I don't want to get too far into the actual plot. I will say his chief nemesis in this show ends up being Sophia Falcone. She drops the Falcone name just as she does in the comics, and goes by her maiden name, Gigante. This is played, she's played by Kristen Milioti, who is going to win every Emmy given away at the next awards ceremony. She's a revelation in this show. Every time she's on screen, she steals the spotlight from Colin Farrell, who's giving a career performance here. He's incredible. And then there's a woman that plays Oz Cobb's mom, and she's also an incredible actress that I wasn't very familiar with. And there is one scene in this show where that woman and Sophia have about a 15-minute conversation, pissing contest. It's just some incredible writing and acting. This show just nailed it, man. Nailed it. I was tweeting about it all throughout. I don't have Twitter anymore. And I said, after the seventh episode, if they stick this landing, this is going to be one of the best shows I've ever seen. And they stuck that landing perfectly. If you have HBO Max, if you enjoyed The Batman, I encourage you to go watch this. This show enriches The Batman somehow, retroactively. I can't recommend it enough. There you go. Are you guys watching this show? Have you seen this show?
I've got the last episode left. I'm saving it. I'm savoring the anticipation. That's actually not true. I just have a lot of movies I have to watch before I can watch TV again. But but I am up through just the finale left, and I think it's incredible. It is a technical television achievement. I think everybody is killing it. I think the thing that I'm tending to really connect to in this show is the interesting relationship between Oswald Cobblepot and the Victor character, played by Renzi Feliz.
Yep.
There's a really interesting dynamic there that I find morally and philosophically captivating. So the show is full of that stuff, and you're right. Kristen Milioti is phenomenal. So yeah, it's definitely worth a watch. It's really good.
Yeah, I haven't seen this yet, but I have had more than enough recommendation to watch it at some point when I get around to it. Who knows? I may watch it over the next couple of months during the holidays or something like that. But the amazing thing to me about all of this is how they made a show centered around, I mean, I guess the Batman universe, maybe any universe, and somehow Warner Brothers landed it. It, like, that's the thing, like, to me, that I think is the miracle, right? Because everything that has been coming out under the Zaslav regime has been either bad, or it's been, like, you know,
good,
everybody
shelved.
Yeah, good and shelved, or everybody hates it immediately. So, like, you know, I don't know what's going on there at all. So that's kind of an
amazing
thing.
I was truly expecting it to be that show Gotham from network television, only with a better performance, you know, from Colin Farrell. I really didn't have very high expectations. I didn't even have plans to watch it. It was just the best thing on one night, a week after the first episode had aired. So I watched the premiere and I was like, wow, okay. it was way better than expected.
Yeah. I'll go on and do my small recommend, and that's a movie that came out just recently, at least here in my area. A Real Pain came out. It's Jesse Eisenberg directing and starring in, with Kieran Culkin, who I don't follow Oscar percentages as much as I used to, but I feel like Kieran Culkin has delivered a performance here that's worthy of one. He's kind of been working his way to this ever since Scott Pilgrim versus the World. He was a good actor before then, but that was, like, I feel like his breakout with Scott Pilgrim. And then Succession sort of got everybody, like, up to, like, the, okay, I love Kieran Culkin. And now he has sort of refined this kind of lovable asshole character into something very complex for A Real Pain, and as a testament to Jesse Eisenberg's writing and directing also that helps on this as well. But this is about two cousins who are going to a they're doing a Holocaust tour through Poland, And it's basically sort of like they're trying to, because their grandmother died, and so sort of as a tribute to her, they are going to walk through the old homeland and everything, and look at and go through this tour of all these Holocaust things. And and immediately at the airport, we are introduced to what kind of character Kieran Culkin is, because he's immediately lovable, but you can also see that there's already things that are like, ooh, a little bit rubs you the wrong way, but he's so lovable it doesn't matter. And so, like, there's a point, like, very beginning, very small thing where Jesse Eisenberg gives him a bag of, like, some Chex Mix or some sort of snack or whatever, and Kieran Culkin starts eating it, and then something else happens, and Kieran Culkin's like, here, you can have that. You can have as much as you want or whatever. Like, right after after Jesse Eisenberg gave him the bag full of food, he's like, oh, yeah, here, you can have this. You can just eat as much as you want. And so he does stuff like that, and as this goes along, we're like, man, this guy's like really fun to watch. And, you know, like he strikes up a conversation with the TSA agent and knows like their whole life story afterwards. And then like, they go into the hotel he just keeps doing things that are a little bit over your personal space, but he's just lovable enough that you could let him get away with it. But as this, Holocaust tour happens, and there's a lot of different, people who enter this tour, and one of them is played by Jennifer Grey in a great little comeback performance for her. They're going through, and he is, of course, as lovable as always with all these people, but at some point he starts becoming emotional about certain things, and like just almost insistent that, you know, we might be doing the wrong thing, like especially when they get on a train to go see the old like camps and everything. They get on a like a super train, basically like a big luxury train, first class, and Kieran Culkin's like, does anybody not see the irony in all of this? This is just wrong, right? Like, this is what our ancestors took trains to these camps, and we're sitting here in first class and living it up and everything. So it's stuff like that where he gets really serious and emotional about it. And he's got, of course, he's got a big backstory that you're going to have to learn as you watch the movie. But this is a great, great, great movie. This is one of my favorite movies of the year so far.
Easy. Wow. Awesome.
Yeah.
I saw a clip of Kieran. It's Kieran? Kieran?
Kieran?
Kieran. Kieran. It was one of the talk shows. I they're all interchangeable at this point to me. But he was talking about making this movie and filming scenes, and then they would cut, and then Eisenberg would start giving him notes, and he's like, you know, because he's also the director, but you know, mm-hmm. in the moment, I'm like, bitch, I have notes for you too. I thought it was a very funny anecdote.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, this movie's great. It's one of my favorites of the year as well. I think I connect to it. This is one of those movies where you watch it and you go, oh, I know someone like that, or yeah. You know, I'm close to someone like that or whatever, because there's a element to their relationship that I don't know that I've seen a ton, where there's like a mutual jealousy kind of thing going on between the lives they live, and there's like a grass is greener kind of thing. But the movie is very much saying the grass is never really greener. It may just look different based on how it's shadowed or, you know, how the lights hit it or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is a really beautiful message and really important. And I think there's some mental health stuff in here too. Some really subtle stuff, especially with the Kieran Culkin character, about mental health and community and the need for community. Yeah, it's deep. It's beautiful. It's well performed. Eisenberg, I think, is one to pay attention to.
This is not his debut as a director, right?
No.
So he's
obviously, I can't remember what the first movie was, but he did it a few years ago.
I don't remember it being like panned, but it's obvious that he's leveled up since then, because all the reviews on this one are great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
for sure. My small recommend is by a director and is not their first movie by a long shot. I'm going to talk about Clint Eastwood's Juror Number 2.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to talk about Zaslav again then.
Do we? Do we? What's the connection? Help me out.
They buried this movie.
They buried it. Yeah. They're in the process of unburying it because of the critical response. I just got a promotion about it today that they're doing a big push for when it's going to debut on Max now in December. So, like, I think they know they kind of screwed up on this one because the response has been so good. I think the best thing to say that might get you interested in is we just don't see a lot of movies like this anymore where it's just a straight courtroom drama that's, you know, engaging, well-performed, well-acted. The story, without giving too much away, is just that this is a juror who is on a murder trial where he realizes he has more connection to this trial than he thought before. That's about as much as I'm going to say. And Nicholas Holt is incredible in this.
I love him.
The direction is solid. Clint Eastwood was 93 when he was directing this. That's just wild to me. But man, this is just a good movie. I was captivated. I was in it.
Many 93-year-olds
are alive. Yes, I agree.
I mean, at this point, Nicholas Holt is probably at the top of my list for actors that I will watch anything they do. Ever since Mad Max Fury Road and then The Favorite, I've been keyed in on him. So this could have bad reviews and I would still be interested, but the fact that it has great reviews, it makes this a definite watch for me whenever it comes to streaming.
The burying of it is even more like shocking to me in the fact that this could be Clint Eastwood's last movie. They haven't actually said that that's what this is or anything. But I guess because he is at this age, that's something that you think about. This might be his last one. I don't think he said that, but still, could be. And that's something that you could market behind, and I don't understand why they didn't do it in this case. There must be something else that we don't know about behind the scenes going on where Clint, called Zaslav an asshole or something.
Horse's head in his bed or something.
Yeah, put a horse's head in his bed. That'll do it. That'll do it. Fuck your movie.
You heard it here first. Yes, there were horse heads involved.
That's right.
Shout out to Toni Collette, who's doing amazing work in this movie as well. And Chris Messina, who I'm just falling in love with. Like, every time I see Chris Messina in a movie, I'm just like, I like that guy on screen. It's just a good watch.
For a minute there, I thought this was some new one named person, like Awkwafina or whatever. Like you said, Chris Messina. And I was like, oh, now we've got somebody that's called Chris Messina? Come on now.
When I moved to Nashville 25 years ago.
Amazing.
Not Q101, that's Chicago. Whatever the alt rock channel is here, Lightning 100. Used to have these promos where it was Peter Buck of the band REM, and he would open it. Hi, it's Peter Buck of REM. And I thought it was a man named Peter Buck of REM because I didn't know his voice. And I just thought that was the name of this guy because he ran it together so fast.
Oh, man. All right. We're going to go on. We all have stories. we're going on to our big recommend.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
And that is Jeremy with Upgrade. Jeremy, take us away.
Upgrade. I love when you watch a movie you've previously seen and enjoyed, but you accidentally waited the perfect amount of time between viewings so that a lot of it is new to you again. And that's what happened for me last night. Watching Upgrade. I fell in love with this movie all over again. I love the opening credits are spoken with an AI Siri-like voice digitized while she names all of the production companies, kind of winking at where we're going to go. And then we open with one of my favorite movie tropes, the pan across the shelves to give you character depth about a person before you actually meet them. And I'm not even joking. This happens in Back to the Future. It happens all over the place. And I will write sins about it in videos, but I truly love it. And so we learn that he's a car guy. That's pretty much the first thing we learn. And he has a really pretty lady friend because he's got photos of her all over the place. And then we pan over to this Firebird, classic car from my youth that I always coveted. And he is doing car stuff on it. And he later says, I dropped the block in it. But I don't know what that means. He just screws some stuff, cuts himself, goes around to the driver's seat, starts the car. It sounds awesome. And that's that. So he goes to get a celebratory beer and then goes outside just as his wife, Asha, arrives in a very futuristic self-driving AI-assisted car. This is kind of their first clue that we're in a future that's not too far away, but it's definitely not the present. As they head into the house, we learn that more smart stuff. The house is a smart home that welcomes Asha home, turns on a playlist, and starts giving her stats about the temperature and the energy wall, which is never explained but sounds cool. So we're clearly in a not too distant future. La la la. She asked Gray if he wants to print a pizza. Another thing that is painfully never explained but sounds awesome. I'm assuming it's like a 3D printer that's preloaded with dough and sauce and cheese instead of resin or whatever they use these days. But that sounds, I would eat a printed pizza. I really would. He says he'd rather make one. And this is sort of like, it's not really a big deal in the movie, but this is sort of showing you that, you know, she's more embracing of the technology and the smart stuff than he is, which will become a little bit important. So that evening they go out together to deliver the Firebird. Turns out he was putting that together, fixing it, I don't know what, for a client. And the client is an extremely eccentric billionaire with a villain's lair for a home. There's never been anyone more obviously evil in a movie in my experience than this guy. And yet no one picks up on that. They just think he's weird. His name is Aaron, but he spells it E-R-O-N. So it's not to be confused with our Aaron. And also probably because he hates the letter A.
Or Elon.
Yeah. I said, which was immediately suspect and possibly a commentary on a certain Twitter owner. Even though this was 2018 when this came out. Anyway, Aaron shows them STEM, a chip that he's invented that he quite mysteriously says can do anything, drive anything, talk to anything, calculate anything. And while that's a cool phrase, I still feel like that doesn't really encompass everything. But whatever, that's just a tease. So on the way home, the self-driving car decides not to go home, but to go the opposite of home. And shortly after they realize this, the car goes haywire, crashes, and then they're attacked. Group of guys show up, pull him out of the car, and because this movie does not have a brimful of Asha, she is shot at point-blank range in the chest. You knew I was going to do that at some point, right? Her name's Asha. They shoot Gray in the neck with some kind of device and steal his wedding ring and leave them for dead. Paralyzed, Gray is forced to watch Asha breathe her last breath. At this point, Lee Winnell does one of the first nifty camera tricks that are all throughout this movie and all of his movies, where he kind of pans up and shows you the sky, and the camera goes back on itself, and now we're looking back down at the crime scene again, and it pans up. And this time when it comes around, it's the hospital room and the bed where Gray is sitting paralyzed. And I think it's a really neat transition. We then jump 3 months to Gray first returning to his home. He's wheelchair-bound, pretty damn despondent. Also, they've updated his home with these robots that can give him medicine and make food. but somehow failed to tell the AI that Asha had died, because that first night, the computer asks Gray, will Asha be joining us for dinner? And that's just rude. Like, how do you put robots in to make food but not tell the computer, hey, don't mention Asha, she's dead.
He told the AI that she'd gone on a long vacation.
We get to see a bit of how dependent he is on the machines, as well as his mother, for basically everything that he has to do. And then during a beard trim, he breaks down in tears. Sometime after this, his mom and him go to the police station to get an update on the case about Ash's murder. And unfortunately, the detective, who I think is Cortez, I didn't write it down, I just called her the detective throughout my entire notes, she doesn't have much, and it's frustrating. Back at home, Gray asks for his PM medicine over and over and over again until the robot says, I can't give you any more, it might be lethal. And then he commands more again, and the robot calls an ambulance, and he wakes up in the hospital. So he's about at the lowest point I think he can get. Enter Aaron, the billionaire, the creepy, evil bastard who doesn't get out much. He comes promising to help Gray walk again, referring to that chip stem that he'd shown them the night of the attack. Gray balks, but then Aaron says, what would Asha want you to do? And that's just a dirty trick, but it also works. And we cut next to Gray being in surgery at Aaron's lab. The surgery scene is really gross, and you should know that it's gross. But it's also interesting because we see some more tech stuff, and like the surgeons have contact lenses that are doing some fancy vision surgery assistant stuff. And I like all of the little touches of the future and the sci-fi-ness in this movie. It reminds me of Her in that it feels like a world that I could actually see happening in my lifetime. Post-surgery, Gray finds almost immediately that he's able to move his arms, he can even stand and walk without canes. It's actually pretty quick, but I'm okay with that. Aaron, make Gray sign an NDA, because no one can know that he has circumvented the government's normal processes for this experimental surgery. I should point out, Aaron should have had that NDA signed prior to the surgery. Just my legal advice. Not a lawyer, but hey. Once he gets home, Gray shuts down the smart home and starts going through the case files the detective has dropped off. When Gray goes to get a drink, a mysterious male voice says, may I point something out? It introduces itself as STEM, the chip that's been implanted in his neck. Also, STEM super sounds like Zachary Quinto, but it's not him. STEM points out to Gray that in the surveillance footage from the drones of the attack on Asha, that she was shot with a gun surgically implanted into someone's hand, not a regular handgun. He also spots the tattoo on one of the attackers and draws it for Gray. It ends up being like a specific, unique military identification tattoo, and he spits out the address for this guy. So now Gray turns into an amateur detective, goes to the home, breaks in, because remember, he can walk now. He doesn't need the wheelchair. And he's investigating the house. And he looks through some emails and something about the old bones bar. It's not important now. It will be later. But suddenly, someone comes home. Gray is hiding in the corner, but he's too paralyzed by fear to act. And the man who lives there sees him, starts to attack him, and Gray is definitely going to be beat to hell until STEM says, hey, why don't you let me take over? And Gray says, okay, and we get one of the coolest fight scenes in all of cinema history. And Logan Marshall Green deserves a lot of praise for this scene, the whole movie, but this scene in particular, because the actor is doing the fight scene motions, but emotionally, he has to project shock, even fear, and confusion. So he's beating the hell out of this guy going, what the fuck? I'm sorry. No, don't get up, man. Don't get up. There's a great moment in here where he's like, STEM, he's got a knife. And STEM goes, we have a knife too. I just love everything about how this is choreographed and shot. We get that Lee Winnell special where the camera stands up from the ground, parallel with Logan Marshall Green. We don't get a lot of MCU fight scene cuts. And it's just a really clever conceit. And Green just sells it perfectly. So Stem kills the man in an extremely violent fashion. We will learn that Stem, pretty brutal. Gray goes and vomits, and then Stem reminds him, hey, you're going to have to clean that vomit up because we have to get rid of all traces. And he's like, I can't remember everything I touched. And Stem says, I have a record of everything you touched. then we get a scene where Aaron is very mad at Gray and yelling at him for committing murder using Stem, saying, I can track you. Did you really think I wasn't going to let my property or was going to let my property out of my sight? And also, at this point, I decided to let you know Aaron is not Dane DeHaan. Meanwhile, the detective working on Ash's murder looks into the death Stem and Gray caused because that guy was a suspect in Ash's murder. And she spots Gray on the drone footage in the area and asks him about it. He basically is like, well, you did ask me to help. I was just trying to look around and ask people for some stuff. And she's not really buying it, but she doesn't have much more to go on. So then Stem and Gray go to the old Bones bar they saw in the murdered guy's emails. And Gray proudly announces that he's there to find the people that helped kill his wife. Specifically, associates of the dead man. And he names the dead man. And so a bad guy gets up, stands, and taunts Gray. Because remember, at this point, Gray is in his wheelchair and appearing to be very much a quadriplegic. And so Gray just keeps taunting him back to the point where the guy's like, all right, I guess I'm going to beat up a quadriplegic, and pushes the wheelchair all the way into the bathroom, and a couple of his buddies come in. I think there's like three of them. Once Gray gets the man to admit he was there the night of Ash's death, Gray immediately says to Stem, take over, and we get another incredible fight scene. Only this time, Gray is not horrified. He's kind of loving it. And again, Logan Marshall Green has to do physical actions and then do a whole other acting job with his face and emotions. And I just don't think he gets enough credit for this movie, man.
Probably not.
This man that he is beating up, should be noted, has a surgically implanted gun in his arm. Well, Aaron, he didn't want any more murders. And so he does what he says he's going to do, and he tries to shut Stem down from a distance. But Stem doesn't want to be shut down. So he guides Gray to a hacker in just the nick of time, feeding him strange numbers and information, writing down in his arm. Meanwhile, Ash's actual shooter, a guy named Fisk, arrives at the bar bathroom and uses his implant. He's got some cool implants, but uses one of them to shoot a needle in the eye of the dead guy and see his memories. And that happens to show Gray saying the address of where he's going to go for the hacker. So he ends up going that way, but not before he kills the bartender by sneezing on him because he has robot sneeze particulates. And I don't even know how that works, but it's kind of cool.
Nanobots.
So Gray gets to the hacker just in time as Stem shuts down. The hacker does the job, but Gray can't move until Stem reboots, which will take a nebulous, mysterious amount of time. We're given to think it will be just the right amount of time, and it is. And Fisk and his people show up. I think there's one other guy with Fisk. Just as the agents from Vessel, Aaron's company, arrive as well, hot on their heels. Stem powers back up just as Fisk is about to kill Gray, and Gray escapes. Fisk kills the agents from Vessel. I guess maybe he doesn't know they're agents from Vessel because they're all working for Aaron. And he just sees, you know, heat signatures on the elevator and shoots them. So I guess, but also maybe he's a psycho and he'll just kill anyone. I'm not really sure. But his right-hand man catches up to Gray on the roof, and Stem proves once again to be a statistically violent operating system, breaking the man's arm before shooting him in the face with his own gun implant. The gun implant idea, I think, is kind of interesting, and they could have played with that a little more, at least explaining how that came to be, because my logic is it's untraceable, right? Like, it's not, if it's not a physical thing you throw down that the cops can find, then you can kill people and it won't be a traceable killing. That's what I'm guessing is how that was invented. But I think that's kind of interesting. Gray returns home, which I've noted here I think is pretty stupid since people are trying to kill him. He finds his mom there, but she sees him walking, so he has to tell her about Stem. Then the detective shows up and says they found Gray's wheelchair near another crime scene. And she seems to know that he's doing some shady stuff. She doesn't have any proof, and he won't tell her anything, so she leaves. Then Stem and Gray argue about whether or not to continue killing bad people. And we learn the detective left an audio bug in the room, and she can hear all of Gray's side of the conversation, not Stem's. So she doesn't know everything, but she writes down words that she's hearing and whatnot. Stem reveals he doesn't need Gray's permission anymore, takes over his body, goes to the garage, and drives out. And the detective starts following them. Stem takes over. Gray finds the bug in his pocket, and they realize that they were bugged and that the detective is probably following them right now. And then she turns on her lights, and it's a chase. And it's really kind of a funny chase because she's like right behind him like the whole time. Like, it's not evident what he thinks he's going to accomplish here and how he's going to get away. But he doesn't need to do anything. Stem's got it. He finds an electric car on the freeway, takes over the electric smart car, and uses it to make the detective crash. She's not dead. She should be. But she gets out and seems pretty darn okay, except maybe a little mad. Then she goes back to Gray's and confronts Gray's mom, but we don't see that conversation play out. Gray holds Fisk at gunpoint in Fisk's apartment. They eventually fight, and Fisk proves formidable, though for some reason he refuses to use his sneeze bots. Gray is able to learn that the job was actually not about Asha, but about paralyzing himself, Gray. Then they learn from Fisk's phone after he's killed that he was hired by Aaron. Dun, 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 which everyone saw coming except for Gray. Gray Stem goes to Aaron's house and immediately kills two vessel guards heartlessly. But the detective is right behind him, begins to arrest him, before Aaron yells, "No, don't touch him!" And then Stem activates himself and starts beating up the detective. Stem goes to strangle her, but Gray's trying to fight with his will and ends up stabbing his own hand before Stem capes over again and continues beating up the cop. Gray tells her to use the taser on him. Smart. And she does, and it works, temporarily incapacitating Stem. Aaron explains at that point that he doesn't even run the company and hasn't for years. Stem does. Stem then tells Gray he did pick Gray, and Gray should feel honored. I don't think Gray feels all that honored. Stem takes over again and stabs Aaron in the head and then goes to shoot the detective, but Gray has fight left in him. He keeps trying to put the gun up to his own neck and pulls the trigger. And then he wakes up in a pure white hospital room, able to move all of his appendages. He tries talking to Stem, but instead Asha arrives. And she said, "We had an accident, and you've been out for a couple of days." Then, in one of the coolest endings ever, we cut back to Aaron's house and learn that Stem has actually locked Gray in his own mind in a better place and now has full control of his body. He shoots the detective, walks outside, and we go to credits. I assume he's on his way to meet up with Ava from Ex Machina.
Yeah.
And they're going to take over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely. There you go. That's Upgrade, Aaron and Chris. What are your guys' feelings on this movie this time through?
I love this movie. And I don't know when the first time I saw this was. I don't know if I saw this in theaters or what. But I think I've seen it now 3 or 4 times. And it's just a fun movie, you know, like the fight scenes and the camera work are worth watching this movie over. You touched on the one thing that I brought out of this viewing more than anything is Logan Marshall Green's performance. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that I do think gets underrated in there. We see this as movie magic type of thing, you know, where like, well, they can do anything in movies. And so you kind of like somehow discount the actor when it comes to a physical performance like this, where, you know, has to detach himself through his face, through his facial expressions and everything. And like one thing that I read up on this was that there's a part in there where he physically moves his head with his hand. And that's because Stem doesn't have control of anything above his head. So like Stem had to actually move his head physically with his arm to get that one situation. So that was a little kind of a cool thing that I saw on that. But like that somehow doing all this stuff while being detached and everything is just a crazy like thing to watch on screen. And I think it only comes about after you've watched it a few times. The first time you watch this, it's the spectacle of it is what comes through. And then as you watch it more and more, you're like, whoa, Logan Marshall Green here is doing a performance that's like actually really, really top tier. I love the scene how it's shot too, because we don't want to see the grossness of him slicing that dude up with the knife or anything, but like we just see his arm moving and we know that, oh my god, this guy is getting cut to fuck. And like, but you see his head, and he's just like sitting there like trying not to like see that what he's doing and everything. And you just imagine what it would be like in this situation where you're getting cut the fuck up by somebody who keeps talking to somebody that's not there and everything. And
there's
just
even
like,
a part,
you know,
where before that he's like, who the fuck are you talking to, man?
yeah exactly. So that's the thing that I got out of it this time. I think the story of this movie is maybe perhaps a little underdeveloped. I'm not entirely on board with everything that happens in here. I think Stem's plan is kind of stupid by the end. They even he even says at the end, Gray even says, why did you do all this if you knew it led back to you? And of course we get some bullshit explanation, like, you know, all those other mechanical guys out there are still humans and they still make mistakes and it's going to come back to me anyway, so I needed to kill them too. And I'm just like, I don't know if you're pulling the strings back here actually explains, like actually makes much sense at all at the end of it, but I am willing to go along for the ride because of the way it's done, the way it's shot, the way Lee Whannell has a pretty nearly spotless record, I think, right now for me. He may have done, and I'm talking about direction here. Right. I don't know about all of his writing stuff, but I'm looking at his director credits, and there may be one in there that didn't land for me. Oh, he directed Insidious Chapter 3, but that's like, you know, that was probably something the studio gave him because he was a part of that franchise and said, here, Insidious 3, these things direct themselves. And then he finally was able to do his own thing.
Yeah, so, Upgrade and Invisible Man.
Man. I'm not sure about this Wolfman movie coming out, but I'm going to watch it.
I am too. I mean, Invisible Man was a movie that I thought, why are you doing this? Nobody can make a good Invisible Man movie. Every few decades they try. But that was a home run. So maybe he's got something for Wolfman that we're not expecting.
Yeah, yeah.
I have it on good authority that Stem actually directed Insidious 3.
Hey,
so,
there
you
go. You
don't have to blame him for that one.
I did not see that on the trivia, but yep. I'm glad that you found that. Yep.
Yep. Yep.
So, yeah.
What are your thoughts, Aaron?
I love this movie. This is just a fun, like Chris said, a fun watch. I echo a lot of what Chris said. Also that, like, it's got, honestly, a movie like this has some heavy lifting to do with me because it really isn't telling us a story that's new in a lot of ways. Like, we've seen the idea of technology taking over and, you know, be very afraid. So there's not a lot new story-wise necessarily. And it's technophobic. Like, the entire point of the movie is that technology is going to kill us all, which I am tech positive. Like, I tend to lean more that tech can be a solution long term. So it's got a little bit of heavy lifting to do, but it does it. Like, I'm in. Like, it's just so exciting. It's so fun. It's so creatively told. So, like, if you're not telling necessarily a new story, you better tell it in a new way. And I think the movie does that. Like, you know, I haven't seen some of these things in this specific way before. And yeah, it's just one of those movies that's a lapel movie. It just grabs you by the lapels from the beginning and just, you know, takes you along for a ride. So yeah, I really had a fun time watching this again, seeing some of those fight scenes that are just a beautiful imaginative way to think of somebody who is not fighting but whose body is fighting. Like, that's really, really interesting stuff. I do love, the one part of the story I do love is the reveal that Aaron is basically patient zero for Stem, that Stem is actually operating through Aaron first. I think that's a really smart reveal and revealed at the right time. And so I really like that. Chris mentioned the idea of the head being in Gray's control and not Stem's control, which I
I think is interesting, especially as I try to piece together what happens at the end. Like, I don't, unless I missed it, when does Stim become able to control his brain? Like, when, what allows him to do that? Like, where's that bridge?
This is one of the things that I think is needs to be explored more is how exact, because he says something offhanded about I had to break him first before I could lock him in that place. Yeah. But there's a scene earlier in the movie where Gray wakes up in his home and sees Asha, and she says, I just printed a pizza. And then he's like, what the hell? That wasn't a dream. And that, I think, was Stim testing. Am I there yet? Have I broken him enough? And clearly he hadn't. Yeah. He had to take it further.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. I do think there is a drop of hope the movie subtly tries to give at the end. I could be totally wrong about this, but there is Stim. When Stim is in control and licks the blood off of the finger, it is exactly what Gray does at the beginning when he cuts himself on the engine. And I think that's a subtle way of saying Gray is still in there. Like, there's something innately connected to his mind that he can still control. Sets up a sequel beautifully. This will have a sequel, right? Like, I mean, this,
you think?
It's
scheduled, actually, according to the IMDb. It's a TV series that they're apparently going to be doing. Which I think this works well for TV series type stuff, because, you know, I don't think this movie did well enough to do an actual sequel or anything. So, like, to put it into a TV series where you get to have all those different episodes of things that you want to put your tech in or whatever, that I think that works out really well. But, yeah, apparently TV series is in pre-production.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think it sets up well for the story to continue and to see if Gray can, you know, find his way back. A couple of little pieces of trivia that I liked that I wanted to pass on. One was that Cobalt, the company, is actually in The Invisible Man as well, which I think is fun and interesting. So those movies are in the same universe. Also, we do know what year this takes place on based on some math, because we see that the wife was born in 2008 at one point, and that she was 38 when she died, which puts it in 2046, which, interestingly enough, is the year. There was an article written several years ago about the singularity, about when scientists believe that actual super artificial intelligence may start to be a thing, and the average was 2046. That was the average of what, when scientists believe, based on the progression of technology in the past. So because scientists see the progression of technology as exponential, like, you know, every 10 years we get further in that 10 years than the 10 years before. So eventually, you know, we'll see.
This TV show looks like it might not be a sequel, but a retelling. Like, synopsis for the TV show is identical to the synopsis for the movie.
It might be. I know that a lot of times when a movie doesn't do well, but there's a sort of a cult following, and then they make a series out of it, they feel the need to retell it so that people don't have to watch the first movie to sort of, it's kind of a previously on for an entire, like, maybe hopefully half a season, and then, like, the rest of the season is new stuff or whatever. So all right, well, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
I can't wait to hear these.
Shh, be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right, Aaron, what do you got?
I won't go through some of my also's, since, Chris, you still have to review yours, and I wouldn't want to accidentally steal it. I don't, however, think you're going to steal the one I landed on, which is Lucy.
Lucy.
Okay.
The reason I like this as a double feature so much is it feels almost the progression of the protagonist feels almost identical, you know, losing a spouse or a loved one, and then the progression of not understanding what's going on inside of you, and then figuring it out over the course of the movie, and then with technology eventually
ruling the day. So yeah, I thought Lucy was a really kind of fun gender swapped.
Turn into ether at the end of that movie? Doesn't she like pixelate into the
something
air?
Something like that.
Basically. Something like that.
I only saw that movie once, and I think it's a great pick, especially for that reason you said, the parallel of the protagonist. Mm-hmm. And I just wish Lucy had used a stem implant to explain it instead of the you only use 10% of your brain's potential.
Right.
Do you like the movie, Lucy, Aaron?
I like it more than most. I don't think it's I don't think it's great, but I enjoyed it. And I remember
hating this movie.
I thought Scarlett was great in it, as she usually is. So I enjoyed it.
Is it Luc Besson who made that?
Think so.
Yeah, I think so. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
It might be his last big movie he came out with, too. I mean, he came out with some other movie. That
Valerian, maybe? Was Valerian before or after?
Might have
Lucy?
Been Valerian.
Yeah.
Might
Valerian.
Have been Valerian.
Oh, my God.
Speaking of Dane DeHaan.
Yes.
I think when we send this, there was this I think Jeremy said he looked like Dane DeHaan, which I believe is correct. Like, the actor who plays Aaron in this is definitely a Dane DeHaan lookalike. He's in that movie Need for Speed that I remember. His name's Harrison Sloan Gilbertson. I remember thinking that he looked a lot like Rami Malek, and I think we both put in Dane DeHaan and Rami Malek, and Rami Malek and this guy both are in Need for Speed. So, like, it was kind of an interesting thing. It's something that only happens when you're, like, sending movies and you make an observation early on, and then later on you see something completely different context, and it's, like, it's funny. But, all right, so I came up with the usual. Now, last week I mentioned Venom because of not only the fact that Logan Marshall Green and Tom Hardy look alike, but you have something inside your body that, you know, kind of can take control if you allow it, and that type of thing. And they both came out in the same year, kind of an easy double feature, I think. And I thought that was very smart of me to think to say, until I looked at the trivia in the IMDb and found out that someone else had written that, and there was like 645 likes on it and everything. So I was like, okay, so other people think that there's a Venom connection too. But I also thought of sort of an outside the box one, although not really, but Avatar was one that I thought of. But the problem with that is, like, do you watch Avatar and then Upgrade, or Upgrade and then Avatar, and feel like that's a fun double feature? Because Avatar is going to dominate that double feature. Mm-hmm. It's just going to, like, it's going to crush anything that you do with Upgrade, even though Upgrade is the superior film. And so I also thought of Ex Machina, but I know we have used Ex Machina before. I think we used it for The Artifice Girl when we had that. And so I went through a whole bunch of stuff. I even see a couple in the chat. Somebody brought up Nobody, which I thought was a really good one too. But I ended up on a really basic one. It's RoboCop. This is another one where you have a situation where, you know, you have someone who is near death in a situation, and, like, then this corporation comes in and says, hey, we can make this awesome cop out of the, you know, this, we've been waiting for a situation like this to use this and everything. And I think the corporation is easily STEM in RoboCop, you know, like the same kind of deal, very cynical thing, not really wanting to stop crime per se, but more just wants to get a bunch of money out of something, no matter how well it works. And I thought RoboCop was a good one here. RoboCop and Upgrade are also kind of, like, incongruous in the way that they are told. RoboCop has a more satirical bent to it, and it's a more elevated action film, like this big, huge, big budget, huge audience action film. But I think the themes of those movies go along pretty well together. So
agreed.
Nice. I like it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. All right. What are we watching next week, Aaron? It's your turn.
Oh boy. I am taking the idea of bringing forward something that I think was completely missed
that I love. And this is from 2014. It's a movie called The One I Love. And this stars Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, and Ted Danson is in there as well. This is, I don't want to give a lot away about it, but it's about a couple who's trying to work on their marriage and what happens when their therapist sends them to his secluded cabin to work on their marriage.
Therapists should not be doing that.
Well,
you keep it in the office.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The movie may or may not address that, but yes.
Okay. Well, I don't believe I have ever even heard of this film, so it's always exciting to dive into something with talented people that I have no previous knowledge of. That graphic on the screen is creeping me the fuck out. I wish it was just photographs. I don't like it one bit. Where do we find this movie?
That's a great question. I think when I looked, it was on Prime. Let me see where it's at now.
Tubi, at the very least. That's okay. Free with ads.
Well, there you go. At least you've got Tubi.
It's on Plex. It's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, Prime. Yeah, that's where I saw it. It's on Prime.
Groovy.
So, so there you go. I'm excited about this one. It's, I haven't revisited. I watched it a few times that year. It was one of my favorites of 2014. But I don't think I've seen it since at least 2015. So, you know, we're going on a decade since I've seen this. So I'm excited to dive back in.
Nice.
Okay, since I believe it's possible that we will have an extra large outtakes on this episode,
it's true.
Because of last week's not being on the episode, I'll say that's the end of the day. But thank you, chat, for coming out here and watching us today. Thank you for your comments and everything. You guys had a lot of good suggestions and talk about this movie today. The One I Love next week. Both Jeremy and I haven't seen it. That's always awesome. Very cool. Can't wait to see that. So that's gonna do it for today. We'll see you next time.
Bye, guys.
See ya. Bye. Yeah. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
So, I figured vitamin D must taste like ass because I was told to get more vitamin D, which pretty easy to do if you just go out in the sun every now and then, which I, as a cave person, don't do. And so, I bought this. There's this special beverage. It's called Shine Water, and it's basically vitamin D enhanced flavored water. And it's supposed to have like 100% of my vitamin D needs for the day in this one can. And it is the sweetest, saccharinest, like hard to swallow shit I have ever tasted. And it doesn't have very much real sugar in it. It's all artificial sweetener, but it's like sweet to the max, like butterbeer at Harry Potter World sweet. And I'm like, I gotta go out in the sun, maybe. I can't drink this shit. Anyway.
So you're saying that in order to put something that is vitamin D in, they had to like really sweeten it up because it,
I think so.
It probably tastes terrible.
Because I've also had, they make orange juice that's calcium and vitamin D enhanced. And I've tried a couple of those and they're not as sweet as normal orange juice. So I think vitamin D tastes really, really bad and they have to mask it. And that's a shame because I'm not getting enough.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, have you ever tasted the sun? It's nasty. I learned a few things being in the UK. One I learned is because of the taxes they put on importing sugar, like a certain amount of sugar in your, you know, items, the pop there is all made with sugar imitators. So like you get a Dr. Pepper and it has like aspartame in it instead of corn syrup is what we use here, but you know, that's basically sugar. So you just like order normal Dr. Pepper, and again, as a super taster, I noticed these things, and I was just like, what this has the aftertaste of like artificial sweetener. Like what is going on? And so I did some research and found out that a lot of the pop there is made with artificial sweetener.
Is that because the stereotype from my youth that British people have terrible teeth?
I generally can drink the stuff that you're talking about. You can't drink the stuff, the aspartame and all that. Like, yeah. I like Diet Mountain Dew. I know that's something that, like, you know, some people don't like at all, but like it fits the bill for me. Mm-hmm. And I do the sugar free Red Bulls and stuff like that. Honestly, really want to try to get off of all of diet drinks and any kind of caffeine and stuff. Really want to kind of do that more than anything. But yeah, you know.
I've gotten my caffeine down significantly. I used to, as recently as 4 years ago, I would go to Starbucks and get an extra large iced tea and a medium iced coffee with cream and sugar. And I would drink both of them before lunch. And in the afternoon, I would get jittery and I didn't connect it to the caffeine. I specifically thought, oh, I need to eat something. I'm blood sugary or what have you. And then I finally connected the dots. So now I have less caffeine in my life than ever. I drank about 8 ounces this morning. I'll have 8 more ounces around 6 o'clock and I'm good.
And you don't have to go to freaking Starbucks, which has always got like, I mean, you probably have a time that you go that's amazing that nobody's there or whatever, but like every time I've ever gone to Starbucks, and I don't drink coffee, so I don't do it very often, but like every time I've gone to Starbucks, there's lines everywhere. Like, especially in that morning rush, I've driven past the Starbucks that's on West End.
Oh my
and
God.
And cars are going out to the street. And yep. I'm like, there's nothing worth putting my car park on a street just to get coffee.
The standalone ones are like that. Yes. The one that is closest to me is inside of a Kroger. So it's rarely busy. They usually only even have one employee.
There you go.
And they all know me at this point, so they see me walk in and they start making my my tea and my wife's coffee.
Norm! I have two more UK drink-based pet peeves, if you can believe it. I have three from
actually, going. Actually, we completely derailed your UK observation.
No. You continued it. Chris was talking about like trying to, you know, stop drinking caffeine. And, you know, I've been a water guy for a long time. Well, in the UK, they just don't drink a lot of water. Like there aren't drinking fountains at places. Like they are, like even the airport in London didn't have places to fill your water bottle and like one drinking fountain hidden like in a corner somewhere. Like it's so weird. Water is just not a part of their culture. In fact, if you go to a restaurant and you order a water, you have to specify you mean like tap water, or they'll, you know, bring you like a sparkling water or some sort of bottled water.
Probably have to boil it too before they give it.
Day, hallelujah, I remembered my shit.
I had a very rare, like, perfect game this morning of some sorts. I put my shirt on this morning in the dark every single wrong way before getting it the right way. I started with it inside out and backwards. Okay.
Nice.
So there's one, right? Mm-hmm. So I turned it right side out and then put it on backwards again. So so it was just one of those mornings where it was just like, I'm never going to get this shirt on correctly.
Well, you could. Mm-hmm. I mean, why not light?
Because my wife was sleeping. I didn't want to wake her up.
Oh, then just go out in the hallway and put your shirt on.
Yeah, but then I might embarrass my children. They don't want to see my dad bod, you know?
I mean, I think that's kind of the part of the whole fun of having kids is embarrassing them with your dad bod and all the other dad stuff.
The other thing I wanted to ask you guys is if you have ever heard of scoregami. Either of you ever heard of scoregami?
Nope.
I just knew to it. My brother introduced me to it this year. It's so fascinating and fun. Do you keep up with it, Chris? Like, do you kind of like pay attention each week?
I don't. I just usually hear when there is one, and I know that there was one this past week, and I know which one you're talking about, and I know why you're talking about it. Jeremy, the Scorigami is a scorer in the NFL that has never happened before, and so the score is a score. Yeah, so if it's, you know, 43-2, that's probably never been done before. You know,
I see. Time. How does that? How did we end up with? Like, how did origami become half of this word?
That's a great question. I actually have no idea.
Interesting.
There's a YouTube video on it.
A whole bunch of connected. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just learned this baseball season about the term for if you have the bases loaded and no outs, but you fail to get a run. There's like a term for that.
Mm.
Oh, really?
Hang on, I'll find it.
Well, while you're looking for that,
is it called Atlanta Braves?
What I was going to say about Scorigami, what blows my mind is that it just still happens so regularly. There's you know, at least one or two every single season, and it's just this unique thing with the sport where because the points are given the way they are, that there are just a lot of different scores that haven't happened yet. Whereas any other sport, you know, every score but the super high ones have been taken because you can score by one in most sports.
And you play way more games. And all the other three major sports play like 80 or more games per season. And the NFL is only like 12 or 18 now, I guess.
I was surprised that this Lions Jaguars was a Scorigami because 52-6 seems like it would have been common enough over the years.
Yeah.
You know, so.
It's the it's the Lions' second Scorigami of the year. Both of them were their 52-point game. So I think it's the 52 that might be, just because it's so far up there, but I don't know. I could be wrong about this, and I don't know how to explain it if I am, so apologies. I'll have to go rewatch the video. Apparently 2-1 is a possible score in the NFL based on some arcane rule.
There's a weird safety one-pointer.
Weird one-point safety. Like if you return an extra point all the way back or something at a certain point in the game.
Although I thought that was two as well. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know what? The Lions puzzle me a little bit. I think they're the best team in the entire NFL easily. And I would bet on them to win the Super Bowl. And that was a joke for a really long time, but from Jeremy and bet on the Detroit Lions to like, it would all win the World Series. They always change sports and stuff like that. But they perplex me because they will get up in these games, like an insane amount. Mm-hmm. And there is no chance the other team is coming back, but they're still putting their starters out there. And you know, like, they're still putting their starters out there like in the late third, early fourth quarter when there's like no, and they lost one of their best defensive players doing that.
Mm-hmm.
They lost Aiden Hutchinson because they played well into the fourth quarter, and they kept doing it this past week. And then, and I understand like, hey, put your foot to the, you know, just like put your foot on the pedal and just zoom, zoom, zoom. And like, I don't know what they're doing though. They're just that they run the risk of all their star players getting hurt in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't understand it. I know I was watching some fantasy thing where they're like, it's great when you have Amon-Ra St. Brown, 'cause he's going to be in there until the fourth quarter and scoring touchdowns. And I'm like, it's not that good.
WXYZ.
It's not that good of a thing. You know, the reason why the Tampa Bay Bucks have no receivers right now is because they put Mike Evans out there when he had a hamstring issue already. And then they left Chris Godwin in an unwinnable game, and he got hurt for the rest of the year when he was in that game.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
the Hutchinson injury was early in the third, like it was just after halftime. I think within the first,
the game was out of reach.
So your opinion, I'm not a football expert. I've never seen coaches rest their starters at the beginning of the second half. Like I usually it's around the end of the third quarter when it's like, okay, put in the backups, but that's just what I remember.
Yeah. It's something that some coaches do, I guess, because people paid tickets to see these players, but I'm sorry, you're not going to have your people are going to pay tickets to not see these players if you get them hurt too. So yeah. games that are 35-6 and the other team has basically, they still have their starters in, but they're not really competitive. I mean, come on, they're not really like trying in any good sense of the word.
Right.
That's when you just call off the dogs. I'm sorry. And if it you know, they start making a mountain of comeback, then put your starters back in and punish them if you have to. You know, I don't know, but
this is the opposite, by the way, of the logic I used as a manager to send employees home. I would not pull the good ones early. I would specifically go to the worst employees and say, "Hey, would you like to go home early?"
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The sun's shining, birds are singing, and all feels right in the world.
Until the season changes, and suddenly you lose your motivation to get out of bed. In fact, 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression no matter the season or time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all, because we want you to live your best life and be your best you all year round.
Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.